Hi, it's David Remnick. If you're enjoying this podcast, you might enjoy even more of what The New Yorker has to offer. Becoming a subscriber gives you unlimited access to The New Yorker, including Pulitzer Prize-winning reporting, insightful cultural commentary, and fiction and poetry. You'll also enjoy our delightful cartoons, crossword puzzles, narrated stories, and much more. This past year, our readers were gripped by Ronan Farrow's profile of Elon Musk, Heidi Blake's extraordinary tale about Dubai's runaway princesses, and much more. Visit newyorker.com to gain access to all this and more. Use the code POD15, P-O-D-1-5, to secure a 15% discount on a yearly digital subscription. That's POD15 for a 15% discount.
This is The Writer's Voice, new fiction from The New Yorker. I'm Deborah Treisman, fiction editor at The New Yorker. On this episode of The Writer's Voice, we'll hear David Gilbert read his story, The Sightseers, from the November 20th, 2017 issue of the magazine. Gilbert is the author of the story collection Remote Feed and two novels, And Sons and The Normals. Now here's David Gilbert.
The Sightseers. While Paulette was getting ready upstairs, Robert took charge of dinner, which entailed pouring the sparkling water and calling for the children, after which Kiki appeared with the halibut and Brussels sprouts, spinach salad on the side. "Looks delicious," Robert said, placing his phone face down on the table and then interlacing his fingers, as though this public denial of electronics were commensurate with saying grace. "Right, guys?" "Thank you, Kiki," Lana said. "Thanks, Kiki," Friedrich said. "Yes, thanks," Robert concluded, with a warm, conspiratorial smile. Kiki, whom he paid on the books. Kiki from Tibet. My goodness, the calm essence of those people. The work ethic. Plus, she happened to be an excellent cook, almost better than Chef Gary. "Where are you going tonight?" Lana asked. "The Harrisons," Robert said. "Will Flip be there?" "I suppose so." Lana disappeared into her shoulders, her body nowadays like an overcoat, the wind and the rain kicking up from across the table, the turmoils of seventh grade. Over the past year, she had bulked up. Perfectly natural, the pediatrician had told Robert and Paulette. Rocket fuel for the coming launch into puberty, though, just in case, Paulette had eliminated bread and dairy from her diet, and processed sugar, of course. Robert's side of the family had a history of weight issues, as Paulette often mentioned. His mother and younger brother, those round nephews. Thank God they no longer marched to Northeast Pennsylvania for Thanksgiving, no longer had to listen to that nonsense about this being everyone's favorite meal. Turkey with sausage and stuffing, the two varieties of canned cranberry, the sweet potatoes topped with marshmallows, the heedless, almost irresponsible piling up of dish upon dish, the turnips, the peas, the butter-infused Pepperidge Farm dinner rolls, as if they were composing self-portraits in food. Watching them eat seemed vaguely cannibalistic. Robert, for his part, was in optimal shape, training five times a week with a former Navy SEAL and competing in marathons and triathlons. Next year, he planned to tackle the Ironman in Hawaii. "I thought we were having salmon tonight," Friedrich said. "Yeah? Pretty sure." Robert refrained from checking his phone and called in Kiki, who confirmed the switch. The halibut was fresher than the salmon, or so the man at the fish counter had told her. This unsanctioned change of proteins went against the purpose of the posted weekly menu, which was to lower daily stress by preparing the children for their dinners ahead. No surprises, no potential conflicts with lunch. And while Robert himself never trusted anyone who pushed product, whether stocks or warranties or halibut, he decided to let the matter pass without correction. "Oh, okay," he said to Kiki.
"Does this mean next time we have halibut, we'll have salmon?" Friedrich asked.
Robert turned to Kiki.
"I guess so," Kiki said.
"Yes," Robert declared. Salmon for halibut, halibut for salmon. Lana hunched her shoulders even higher. An excellent suggestion, Robert told Friedrich. Yeah, sure, no problem, Friedrich said, unmoved by the fatherly approbation. But Robert was heartened. The old switcheroo, genius. He got up from the table and went over to the floor-to-ceiling windows. The shadow of their building, new and narrow and tall, was tilting across the southern end of Central Park, like a slow-motion salute from above. You have achieved great success, good American. The effect always stirred Robert, and he tried to identify his specific tranche of shade as though he might glimpse himself standing in the monolithic darkness, 83 floors up, see his own small hand waving. He turned back around and faced his children, his dear children, my dear children, he thought. I used to hate Brussels sprouts, he told them. The cue was obvious since Lana was warily stabbing at a green bud, but the tone was unexpected, almost contrived, as though he were reading words written inside his head. Hated them with a passion. It was pure torture, almost to the point of actual weeping. And Graham, she knew I did. Yet every couple of weeks, there they were again, Brussels sprouts. Bobby sprouts, she called them. Bobby sprouts, he repeated, impersonating his mother's witchy voice. She steamed them, all mushy and bitter, just awful. Well, then came Harvard, and I was done with Brussels sprouts, which was one of the supreme pleasures of being an adult, never having to eat Brussels sprouts again. Hallelujah. So I went 20 years free of those, he paused for maximum profane effect, fuckers, until this dinner party, fancy one, and there they were, right under my nose. I was sitting by the host, so I had no choice. I had to eat them, to be polite. And I was scared, literally sweating, but I mustered up the courage and had a bite. They were halved and caramelized and delicious. It was my road to Damascus moment. You know that story, how Saul becomes Paul, one of the apostles, how he goes blind seeing the light of God and converts? No, nothing. Oh, well, just means it was a revelation. These are Brussels sprouts, these things here. And I wondered, had Graham been doing them wrong all these years, or had I finally grown up, or had there been a fundamental shift in the preparation of Brussels sprouts? Lana and Frederick looked at Robert as though he were an embedded commercial in one of their on-demand shows, their eyes trying to click 30 seconds ahead. Anyway, Robert said, uncertain of the point himself. Lana offered him a Brussels sprout. Robert grinned. Very funny. What? Yeah, maybe tomorrow night I'll tell you my complicated history with cauliflower, Robert said. That's not on the menu, Frederick said. I'm kidding. Before Robert could change course and bring up their weekend with the diver certification class and the background lecture on the wreck of the Tecumseh from Professor Miller, Frederick wiped his mouth and asked about the herons, specifically what was going on. Seemed their cams were down, or not down, but just streaming their hotel room, the Ron cam, the Lisa cam, the Stan cam, the Maggie cam, all four cams staring at the ceiling of the Doubletree. Almost creepy, Frederick said. Robert performed mild surprise. Yeah? You haven't been watching? Not really, he lied. They should have gone to Disney World, Lana half whispered, like the Shacklers. Yeah, that looked fun, Frederick said. Wish we could go there, Lana said. What was the name of that ride? Robert asked, pleased by the memory of the Shacklers and their four-day vacation in Disney World, which Robert and his family had sponsored with their initial foray into funded tourism. Splash Mountain, Frederick said. Lana brightened. I'd like to see little Maggie Heron on one of those rides. Well, little Maggie Heron might be dead or something, Frederick told her. Nobody's dead, Robert said. And though he was tempted to grab his phone and check the stream, he simply said once again, this time with conviction, but casual conviction, nobody is dead. But in reality, Robert was concerned. The stream had presented a full and active morning for the Herons, a crack of dawn breakfast, a double-decker bus downtown, visits to the Statue of Liberty and Ellis Island and the 9/11 Memorial, another bus back to Times Square for a late lunch at the Brooklyn Diner. All of this was in keeping with their detailed itinerary, curated by Robert and Co. Some highlights: Stan and Maggie posing with Elmo on 42nd Street, Elmo swindling Ron of $20. Ron and Lisa and Stan and Maggie standing in the wrong line for the ferry. Ron and Stan climbing to the crown of the Statue of Liberty, Ron sweating, Stan disgusted. Maggie at Ellis Island counting every exhaled breath over the course of a half hour until Ron begged her to please stop, sweetheart. Lisa getting teary thinking of her great-grandparents at the Immigration Museum, while Ron focused on a nearby woman, in particular her New World cleavage. Stan pretending to be an airplane in front of the 9/11 Memorial, Ron horrified and chasing after him, briefly resembling the second airplane. Ron and Lisa and Stan and Maggie waiting an hour for cheeseburgers and Nudelkugel, Maggie and Stan panicking over their devices' dwindling battery percentages, Ron staring into the ominously innocuous distance. After lunch, the family retreated to the Doubletree for some rest. Their next activity, a carriage ride through Central Park, had been scheduled for 4 p.m., followed by 6:15 p.m. dinner at the Hard Rock Cafe and an 8 p.m. performance of Wicked. But according to their stream, they were in the hotel room, face up in their beds. "I don't think they're breathing," Frederick said. "They're fine. They haven't moved in like 4 hours." "They're fine. I'm just saying." "Why did they come to New York anyway?" Lana muttered.
"Whatever."
"People dream of this," Robert gestured to their view. "Stupid." With the clack of high heels as overture, Paulette the Symphony rushed in, her silk chiffon dress finished in tiered ruffles, giving the impression that she was bustling through a pile of brightly colored leaves. As always, she seemed to be mid-task, her eyes rearranging great swaths of air, her hands fiddling with imaginary clasps. "We should go or we'll be late," she told Robert.
"I've been ready."
"I know, I know. Just play along." Paulette turned to the children and their immediate needs, which were easier to cope with than the compounding fear of loss and loathing, of being unworthy of any reciprocating love. When they were babies, then toddlers, Paulette mothered without a second thought. But somewhere in their middle school years, the ineffable had been replaced by executive management and peer review, late childhood becoming a series of problems to be solved and then questioned afterward in bed. She was like a threatened CFO. Robert, for his part, just wished she could relax more, though he understood the problematic jiu-jitsu of that statement and so never used that word. Rather, he suggested more yoga, or a massage, or maybe a visit to Mystique. "Not too late tonight, all right," Paulette told Friedrich and Lana. "We all have a big day tomorrow." Paulette then summoned Kiki, who accidentally let Shawnee free from the confines of the kitchen. The dog was part chocolate lab, part Great Dane, i.e., a Labradane, bred by some lunatic in southwest Ohio. Imagine a retriever on stilts. Robert grabbed Shawnee's collar before that crazy tail could do damage and dragged him back to the kitchen. "Okay," Paulette said to Kiki. "They should be in bed by 10. No screens after 8:30 unless they're watching a movie made before 1990. No exceptions. And only in the living room, the two of them watching together." Paulette turned back toward Friedrich and Lana. "And here's the deal. If you're reading a book, you can stay up until 11. Maybe tackle some of A Sorrow in Our Heart or West Wind, Flood Tide." Both children sighed. Paulette aped their sighs in return, the neckline of her dress revealing the core of muscle that in a certain light could be read as skin and bones. "Love you," she said, reflating. "Now damn the torpedoes, full speed ahead." She went over and comically started to push Robert toward the entryway, Robert who had been ready ages ago, Robert who had already picked their housewarming bottle of wine, Robert who was sort of disappointed in her lack of attention vis-a-vis the unsanctioned halibut, Robert, who muttered, "Aye, aye, Captain Farragut." Rear Admiral, Paulette corrected. It doesn't sound nearly as good, but that's what he was. Drayton was the captain. Regardless of these things, Robert raised the bottle of Craw Parenteau as though he were charging into a night of good cheer. As usual, drivers were double-parked around the building, an idling black moat. Though Johnson had snagged the spot in front, Carlos the doorman hustling ahead to open the back door. This piece of service-oriented choreography reaffirmed the magic of New York when the city seemed to bless your passage. You're the best, Robert said to Carlos, feeling the truth of the sentiment. Have a great evening. The door closed and Johnson turned and smiled at them. Hello, my esteemed employers. Johnson, my friend. And he was a friend, Robert thought. Good old Johnson and his wife, Elma, and their impressive boys, Lawrence at West Point and Freddie at Amherst, Robert paying their tuition or paying the portion their scholarships didn't cover. Johnson had once been a cop. All the best drivers had once been cops. They carried guns, or could carry guns. So, the West Village? Johnson asked. Yes, Charles Street. Perry, Paulette said, her eyes fixed on her phone. I thought Charles. Nope, Perry. Perry, then, Robert said. These minor adjustments, Rear Admiral Perry, puncturing his basic sense of well-being. He sank into the quilted leather of the back seat, the wood and hide bringing to mind a paneled library, the windshield its glowing fire. Robert closed his eyes and took a breath. Om Namah Shivaya, he mouthed in his head, as he'd been taught by Seligman, the firm's shaman. He really should mention the halibut. There were protests around Midtown, so Johnson avoided Fifth by heading way west and then south. Though in truth the traffic was horrible everywhere, this version of Endless only 5 minutes shorter. Johnson was a confident driver, right down to his mustache, which reminded Robert of peak Burt Reynolds, Smokey and the Bandit, the Cannonball Run. Talk about the epitome of a man. Robert and his friends in Susquehanna had often reenacted those scenes on red rally bicycles, dreaming of eagle-emblazoned Transams. Not that Robert ever brought this likeness up with Johnson. Some things should remain unnoted. Because otherwise Johnson was chubby and chinless, the skin around his nose and ears red and flaky. What is going on with the herons? Paulette asked. Huh? You haven't been watching? Not really, Robert said, like a serious man. Well, they're not doing anything, Paulette told him, raising her phone and showing him the herons in landscape mode, Ron and Lisa and Stan and Maggie in quarter portions, each cam still streaming its own patch of ceiling. Paulette clicked on the Ron cam, the Lisa cam, the Stan cam, the Maggie cam. All the same, she said, for hours now. Robert accessed the cams from his phone. He always wished he could see the things he missed or rewatch the things he enjoyed, like the four of them riding in a taxi toward the 59th Street Bridge. Robert had insisted on this particular entry into the city. The skyline opening its famous arms to them, those little town blues melting away. The way Ron had muttered, "Will you look at that?" And Maggie mentioning something about the president, about his building in the grand scheme of buildings. The four of them searching for a telltale golden sign. Yes, Robert would have enjoyed watching those scenes again, but there was no recording, only live streaming. "'Tis strange," Robert said, "the tis a surprise." "They missed the carriage ride through the park," Paulette said. "Uh-huh, and their dinner reservation? I'm sure Wicked is next." "Not Wicked," Robert teased. "Shut up, you know what I mean." Paulette opened the mirror app on her phone and checked her makeup against her proposed makeup scheme, her fingers patting and petting the various highlights and shadings as though her skin might respond like a touchscreen. A small blast of frustrated air blew through those black Dahlia lips. Robert understood this as a bid for attention, thanks to their private couples retreat with Dr. Gottman and his wife, Julie. He turned and faced Paulette and told her how beautiful she looked, how her eyes sparkled and her hair was perfect tonight, how lucky he was to have her in his life, even if she was presently annoyed by the limits of her concealer. Paulette acknowledged the affirmation by touching his knee. Then she asked, "Should we complain?" "About what?" "The Herons. I've heard of stuff happening before, like with the Burkes." The Burkes had come across a bout of unexpected lovemaking, which was typical of the Burkes, to have that kind of luck. Their particular mom and dad were in France, and had woken up in the middle of the night and slipped on their cams, and had quiet yet vigorous husband and wife sex while their children snoozed in the adjoining room. Maybe they were trying to give their sponsors some naughty fun. Maybe they had forgotten the time difference and assumed that the Burkes would be asleep instead of sitting down with friends for dinner, those friends being the Meachums, who had shared the story. How, in the middle of their 12-course tasting menu at Oscar, this couple from Kansas had started screwing between the hay-grilled woodcock and the langoustine torched in chamomile and yarrow, the Burkes and the Meachums in absolute tears. Ah, Paris. So unusual things did happen, sometimes bordering on the disturbing, like terrible screaming matches, potential examples of certifiable abuse, miscellaneous bad behavior. But for the most part, the biggest sin was the old sin of being ugly Americans. "Do you think they're dead?" Paulette asked. "Funny, Frederick wondered the same thing." "Well, of course not," Robert said. "They just got sick of streaming and put the cams on the beds and are doing whatever they're doing, free from us, that's all." "So you think they're heading to Wicked?" "I don't know, I would think so." "Because I'd like to see that, the whole family at Wicked. Christ, maybe we should just get tickets ourselves. You know what I mean. We can go to Wicked," Robert said. "It's allowed." "Stop. I'm just saying I'll be happy to go. We are not seeing Wicked." "But we could." "I know, I know." As Paulette said this, she was shaking her head, which Robert refrained from mentioning, despite Dr. Gottman's admonitions about the perils of unconscious undercutting. "It's just, we're paying all this money so they can have a nice trip to New York, and they're not keeping up their end of the deal, which is against the terms of conditions, I assume. We should complain. Otherwise, we're just being our passive, complicit selves, right? There must be a number we can call." "Suppose we were witnessing a crime, like a murder or an actual emergency, and they were in terrible trouble. What would we do then?" "Well, I can check the site." "Remember the Shacklers, how grateful they were for everything?" "The Shacklers were excellent," Robert agreed. They practically took us on their adventure." While Johnson was skirting the madness of Times Square, Robert could still feel the proximate thrill of those blasting lights. This was the New York that had existed as part of his rural imagination before he graduated from Harvard and moved to Astoria. It was a moment in time that was both embarrassing and uplifting, like most of his 20s, ensconced within the familiar parameters of middle-class striving, except Robert had known better. His future success played like an amusing secret across his face, as though he were walking with Enter Sandman in his headphones while everyone else was listening to NPR. The car turned on 23rd Street and then continued south on 7th. They approached Robert's first proper apartment, an unloft-like loft across the street from the old Barney's department store, where he had been introduced to clothes on a whole new level. The strutting delight of that place, even when he was browsing alone, invisible women hanging on his arm. He had often paid in cash just so he could peel the bills from his roll of hundreds. Robert still had a few suits from those days, suits he never wore, yet which retained their spark of joy. "My old haunts," he said. "Yeah, I know," Paulette answered. Robert was curious what Dr. Gottman might say about that reply. Paulette herself was native to this terrain, the Upper East Side her childhood home, so she treated the local geography with a certain amount of coolness. Change for her was more a matter of replacement, nostalgia a series of trends circulating the same theme of money. There was a cynical naivete to her attitude. Robert still found this incredibly sexy. The idea that she had picked him 18 years ago, when making $1 million a year seemed like a big deal. Almost storybook, he thought, on the good days. I never imagined I'd be richer than my parents, she had once told him. A lot richer, he said. Yes, I never imagined that. In this way, she was modest. Barney's had morphed into the Rubin Museum, which was wonderful, or so Robert had heard, a wonderful museum. The collection specialized in the art of Himalayan Asia, as in sculptures of many-armed gods, mandalas created in the lobby by saffron-robed monks. A real gem, though he thought the bigger story was how this Rubin guy had managed to create his very own museum, in Manhattan no less, from the bones of Barney's. Now that seemed an otherworldly feat.
So we do nothing? Paulette asked.
About the herons?
Of course about the herons. It is what it is.
After saying this, Robert was haunted by his own emotional heritage via Dr. Gottman's smiling bearded face, which gently reminded him of how he was turning away and minimalizing, doing something called meiosis, the exact definition of which Robert had forgotten, though he remembered the bit about a pebble not being just a pebble when in someone else's shoe. Then again, Dr. Gottman didn't trade currencies on the foreign exchange. But before Robert could self-correct, the car pulled tight to the curb in front of the three combined townhouses, the Harrison residence. Johnson hustled to open their door.
Wow, full service, Robert said.
Have to put on a decent show. We'll probably be about 3 hours. I shall prepare a noble death song for the day I go over the Great Divide. It was an odd thing to say, but Johnson often said odd things. Okay, then, Robert said, taking Paulette by the hand. Good luck with that. As they made their way up the stoop, Paulette shook her head. It's absurd, she said. Look, I'll call someone later, I promise. No, not that. The doorknob, she said, gesturing. Robert tried his best to glean the brass knob's innate absurdity so that he might understand his wife better. The scale, maybe? It was about the size of an ostrich egg. Or the obvious hand-forged expense? But he came up empty. The temptation to touch this piece of hardware, undone by his fear of leaving behind fingerprints. The exterior maintained the semblance of three separate townhouses, but the interior was open and grand and no doubt involved a level of engineering in keeping with public works in China. During the extensive renovation, the townhouses had been no more than shelves of themselves, like Hollywood sets or the gutted remains of a firebombing, depending on your passing mood. The Harrisons had initially purchased the middle townhouse, and they were beginning work when the townhouse on the left became available. Everything stopped while a new set of architectural drawings was drafted, then submitted, then approved, 18 months elapsing before work began again, when the townhouse on the right became available. The price unreasonable, but what could they do? They were hostage to their own opportunity. So they went back to the drawing board and, 2 years later, commenced construction in earnest. Then they hit water. They were digging 20 feet down in order to accommodate a Turkish bath-inspired indoor pool, or hammam, as Anna Harrison pronounced with cultural respect, when they hit actual water, one of those underground streams that meander beneath the city. Another year of delays, and that's when the townhouse on Charles Street became available.
On Charles? Robert said, glancing toward Paulette.
Yes, Anna said. She was showing them around while Bill entertained the others on the terrace, which overlooked a backyard with a lawn large enough for a game of croquet. It allowed us to create this piazza feel.
Fabulous, Paulette said.
Charles Street, Robert repeated.
It's all been a blessing in disguise. It's the reason we had another child, Anna said. Robert was uncertain if she was kidding. Well, it's spectacular, Paulette said, as Anna guided them back to the cocktails. Just spectacular, she said to Bill and the others, the Van Burens and the Harmars and the de Bourbons, all of whom had already had the grand tour. They were friends, but friends in terms of moving in similar circles, more professional and charitable and institutional than social. Like superheroes, they had their own private hideaways, their own distinct powers, their own secret identities. Robert guessed that if a bomb detonated in Lower Manhattan, four black helicopters would soon be hovering over Perry/Charles Street. They were people with contingency plans. Bill opened his arms. Our pay-to-tear in the village. Nothing like downsizing, Lewis Harmer joked. Who was your contractor? Sally Van Buren asked, decorator and architect being too obvious. As they talked, Robert strolled through the expansive backyard, his eyes taking in the trees and the boxwoods and the wondrous grass, the absolute un-Manhattan aspect of this sanctuary, but also appreciating the bluestone paths and terrace, a particular piece of northeast Pennsylvania geology, the ancient sea receding and leaving behind simple life forms trapped in sediment, the evidence of shallow, fast-moving water still present in the surface of the rock. It was like motion fossilized. Feldspathic sandstone, he remembered from sixth-grade science. And, as was his habit when faced with this type of paver, he subtly sloshed his drink onto the blue-gray surface. There were sermons in that stone. But no view, Anna was saying. No view, Bill said. Which means not great light, Anna said. Yeah, no light, Bill said. And shockingly loud, Anna said. Definitely loud, Bill said. People sometimes just sit on our stoop for hours, Anna said. The stoops are a nightmare, Bill said. They smoke pot. We want to be good neighbors, but these aren't neighbors, Anna said. Just kids smoking pot, Bill said. Sometimes not kids. Robert returned to the group. Who needs a goddamn view when you have this, he said. Paulette looked at him, her brow implying a ripple. I'm just saying it's beautiful. Well done, sir. Robert tipped his imaginary hat. Talk soon turned to politics, as talk did more often these days. Terry Van Buren mentioned his recent six-figure support for the ACLU, Sally doing her part with Planned Parenthood. Lewis and Winnie Harmer were directing their foundation towards African-American and LGBTQ causes, while also helping finance a film about George Washington Carver and Austin Curtis. Maurice and Katerina de Bourbon shook their late empire heads and occasionally muttered that maybe art would get decent again. And Paulette? She listened and nodded. Anna Harrison was talking NGOs, no doubt waiting to mention that she had joined the advisory board of ProPublica and had reactivated her bar membership. Robert watched her and found this moment of marital clairvoyance endearing, more like peering into the past than into the future, glimpsing the lanky girl navigating these social waters. Like those rare times when Paulette would get stoned with him, and within the haze would slough her adult veneer and reveal the unbridled sweetness underneath, the goofy charm. Remember this, Robert always urged himself. Remember this person here. How obviously she struggled. But before Paulette could step into the conversation, Flip Harrison appeared. Her hair pastel-colored and flowing like the mane of a unicorn. Terry and Sally Van Buren brightened. It's Flip. Love the hair, Winnie Harmer said, with Lewis Harmer adding, the flipster. Evidently, the de Bourbons had no history with the esteemed Flip. Lana says hi, Paulette said, doing her part. Robert knew that Lana had said nothing of the sort, so hearing this seemed a betrayal of their awkward daughter, Paulette suddenly racking into sharper focus, her nervous hands, her thin lips,
her need for this 13-year-old's approval, amazing the speed of such fault-finding.
Lana's so funny, Flip said. Such a great gal.
Fuck Flip, Robert thought. Then came this unwanted flash of imagination, him stepping forward and snapping her neck in one of those mortally quick chiropractic adjustments. Flip crumbles, people scream, Paulette screams, and Robert stands there like he's dropped a plate loaded with food.
The gates have opened, Flip said,
gesturing with her tablet computer.
The gates?
Ooh, Anna said, and went to join her daughter. Robert imagined the hell he knew from his Sunday school days, demons dragging down the damned.
Mavis is already crying. It's just so precious.
Bill Harrison checked his phone, smiled in that Bill Harrison way, as though his pleasure were a tradable commodity.
Just look at them, he said,
and then for the sake of the others, he projected the stream onto one of the reclaimed wood planters. The Taj Mahal materialized, empurpled by rising light.
We've got this whole family in India right now, Bill told them. The Altamiras from Grand Rapids, all 10 of them. Mother, father, children, grandchildren.
Nick and Mavis are renewing their vows today in a small, intimate ceremony. Bill toggled between cams. The Justin cam, the Kenny cam, the Becky cam, the Vicky cam. Every cam similar. The grounds of the Taj Mahal. People taking selfies via arm or articulated stick. A few tourists running ahead so they might have a photographic moment alone with the architecture. Mavis and Nick holding hands, grinning with wonder and gratitude.
I guess they feel a kinship with Shah Jahan and Mumtaz Mahal, Bill said.
I think it's sweet, Flip said.
What a romantic, Bill Harrison said, flashing the projector against Flip's romper.
Dad, Flip Mahal.
Agra's a dump, Maurice de Bourbon pronounced.
Winnie Harmer started to mention that they had just sponsored a 2-week tour of Venice and Florence and Rome and Siena.
Yeah, yeah, we get it, Italy,
Lewis Harmer said, snapping his fingers.
All on a tour bus, a great big package deal for this elderly couple.
Pompeii, Lewis added.
That's right, Pompeii, Winnie said. Everyone was so disappointed, yet so spellbound.
The most extraordinary complaining you've ever heard, Lewis told them.
Herculaneum is better, Terry Van Buren piped in. Smaller, but better preserved, certainly less crowded. We went a few years ago and did a 2-week archaeological dig with Dr. Roger Speckle from Balliol College, Oxford. He was fantastic.
Fabulous, Sally Van Buren confirmed.
We helped finance the excavation of the forum complex. The kids had a blast. Flip cutie pied her face. Silas and Beckett are the absolute best.
Well, they think the same about you, Sally said.
Fuck Silas and fuck Beckett, Robert thought, and fuck Flip.
The boys want to sponsor a cruise like on one of those massive ships.
That would be hilarious, Anna Harrison said.
They're raising money by working in the stables and the farm stand.
Good for them, Winnie Harmer said. Robert wondered when Paulette would mention Wicked or their upcoming dive on the USS Tecumseh, when she would speak up and inevitably disappoint him.
Oh, look, Flip cooed as the Altamiras began gathering for a family photo in front of this most famous of mausoleums. Do you know the Taj Mahal took over 20 years to build and would cost $1 billion in today's money?
Hearing this, everyone smiled. Johnson took 6th back uptown, the avenue mostly clear, the run of green lights holding sway, though he sometimes had to throttle up and tweak the edges of yellow. Robert, drunk on expensive wine, silently cheered from the back seat as though the car were bouncing along the track of a roulette wheel.
Quite a place, Paulette was saying.
Yeah.
And the food?
Yeah.
Maurice de Bourbon is a piece of work.
All this was true. In the Harrison's more intimate second dining room was a single painting, a Rothko,
blocks of burgundy and black against a larger block of darkest blue, a minor late Rothko, Maurice de Bourbon had told Robert, who was admiring the painting, or admiring the obvious Rothko-ness of the painting. The color seemed to glow, like those blacklight posters from back in the day, of King Kong and Alice Cooper, cobras and panthers, big-breasted women in bandoliers. Rothko had slit his wrists. Robert knew this without knowing the precise source of the knowledge. The poor man must have been exhausted by his own profound redundancy. The painting had distracted Robert all through dinner, this buzzy black hole in the wall, like an almost sonic blur. The meal consisted of three courses presented by the chef, who was evidently well known in Spain, and who explained in detail the various preparations, his tone implying clandestine pinches of arsenic and cyanide, or so Robert had thought. Robert was feeling bored with the company and blaming Paulette for their inclusion, though Bill Harrison had been his friend since junior year at Harvard. But Paulette cared more, and Paulette should have been above this crowd. She had gone to Brearley and Barnard and Columbia Law, but there she was, laughing as Maurice de Bourbon told a long story about Rothko and the Pale of Settlement and the Four Seasons, no one really following, Maurice ending his monologue on the ecstasy and the doom of turpentine and impotence, which evidently was the punchline. "Look at this," Paulette said in the car. But Robert was more interested in the tricky section of traffic lights through Greeley Square. "Just look." Paulette was holding up her phone, her face as stern as a government agent with a badge. The ceiling of the Doubletree was still glowing in quadruplicate. Nothing had changed. As expected, Paulette had mentioned the Herons during the cocktail hour, how they were going to Wicked after their busy day, though she held back on saying anything about this rogue static. Everyone enjoyed the idea of Wicked. "They haven't moved an inch. Obviously they're not wearing their cams," Robert told her. "So they're flaunting the rules?"
"The rules?
You know what I mean, but yeah, the rules. You and your stupid goddamn rules," Robert said, surprising himself. Paulette glanced toward Johnson. "Like salmon for dinner," Robert continued, "which was actually halibut."
"Huh?
Oh, and Lana hates flip."
"No, she doesn't."
"Absolutely. I promise you she doesn't," Paulette said. "In fact, the opposite." Johnson accelerated. The light passed, perhaps officially red. Robert wished he were driving or up front whooping.
"So you're not concerned?" Paulette asked.
"About the Herons?"
"Yes, about the Herons."
"Nope," Robert said.
"How about angry then?"
"Not at all."
"Angry at me, maybe?
Why would I be?"
"How about annoyed or frustrated or irritated? How about you give me a clue?"
Robert turned away from the streak of lights and looked at Paulette. Her face was trying to express bewilderment, and perhaps there was even amusement tucked into the smoothened furrows, what once would have been a charming squint, as she attempted to decipher the mystery of his feelings. The saving grace of those eyes, a swirling blue-green, like something spotted from the Hubble, Robert had once thought, vast, newly seen distances from the void. How easily he could forget how much he loved her. "Reach for her hand," Robert heard in his head, Dr. Gottman nudging him along. "Find shared meaning." Robert adjusted his posture.
"How about that Rothko?" he tried.
"That was incredible."
"I mean, a goddamn Rothko," Robert said, as the car sped through another near red light.
At home, Paulette held the elevator while Robert hustled into the kitchen and grabbed the dog, Shawnee instantly going all lunatic, loping about, his tail conducting his own excitement. Paulette laughed, seeing man and man's best friend approach. And while Robert could recognize the bullshit sitcom pantomime, he still performed his part. When the elevator was halfway down, his phone chirped. It was Paulette, specifically a photo of Paulette's dress hitched up and revealing her underwear. This was Bill Harrison's doing. During dinner, he had angled the conversation towards sex, as he often did on these occasions, as though in testament to his iconoclasm, his virility. Bill mentioned how he and Anna had gotten into sexting recently, chuckling around the table, and in particular, how they liked sending naughty pics back and forth, how this made their days infinitely more interesting. Those wild Harrisons. Soon enough, Terry Van Buren was sending Sally a photo of himself from the bathroom, Sally cackling, "Oh my God," as everyone pleaded for a glimpse. Robert was thankful that Paulette had refrained from participating, not because he was a prude, but because he suddenly really fucking hated that cocksucker, Bill Harrison. But here Paulette was now, the hint of hairlessness where there was once hair. Robert texted back, "So lovely," trying to be nice. Needing to clear his head and stretch his legs, Robert walked the dog north into Central Park. At this hour, it was empty except for a few bold tourists on the path and random seedier elements who lingered half-hidden in the trees, often just representatives of one's imagination. Shawnee pulled on the leash, easing up on command only to pull again a few seconds later, as if there was a scent, a trail, a pressing need on the other end. Robert reached over and unclipped the leash from the choke collar. He had always wanted a dog who would roam by his side, who would obey sharp clicks of the tongue and patiently wait outside stores and restaurants, who would seek human permission for every canine whim. One of those dogs, not this brainless dope. But he decided to test things, and for a bit Shawnee reflected his $10,000 worth of training. He healed again, he sniffed and peed, but then something happened. Something only a dog would notice or care about, something in the distance, and, head up, tail alert, Shawnee bounded into the darkness.
"Shawnee!"
Robert could hear the rustling of leaves. "Shawnee, come!" Rustle, rustle, stop, rustle, all in reels of blue and gray and black. "God damn it, Shawnee!" Robert scooted between park benches and walked toward the sound, downhill, near the trees that bordered the pond. It was startling, the degree of darkness away from the path. Buildings with their steadying lordship receded behind the sudden presence of nature. The ground cover grew thicker, the air cooler. The smells of soil and other organic material seemed antique in their decay, the outside world like a rolled-up oriental rug. Damp and fading, one of those bygone reminders that mildewed in the basement back in Pennsylvania. Robert noticed blonde shadings of bedrock surfacing from the earth, and for a moment he conjured up humpback whales rising around him, their skin mica-flecked. Robert had loved whales when he was a boy.
"Shawnee!"
A pause for listening. Nothing. No rustling. No jangling from the collar. The more Robert called, the more absurd he appeared to himself. The concerned lilt in his voice, the hopeless scanning of the dark, the rope-like leash limp in his hand, the slow, operatic rise towards panic. Robert oscillated between rage and drunken culpability. Stupid dog. Stupid man.
"Shawnee!"
Like a scene from Lassie, watched while sprawled on the living room floor. Again, Robert listened and searched for movement in the inky Rorschach of trees. The strange, unexpected wilderness of Central Park at this late hour. A culvert, the sound of katydids and crickets in the extended warmth of summer, the weeks before Thanksgiving like the week after Memorial Day. There was no moon above, no stars, the night blurred with surrounding ambient light as though fogged by chlorine. Robert sweetened his tone.
"Shawnee, come on!"
Nothing. He moved closer to the trees. A twig snapped, the result of his own footfall, yet the sound reflected as another presence in the woods, stalking him, and once this idea was introduced, Fantasy took hold. Robert almost laughed, the childishness of this fear. He could have been back in Susquehanna, 10 years old and scared under the sheets, convinced there was an intruder in the house. How he would become both the murderer and the victim, climbing the stairs as he flattened himself under the comforter, his clueless, expendable brother in the other bed. He thought about those missing herons. Maybe they were hiding somewhere in the park, a ridiculous notion, but he could feel their contempt radiating in the stillness, as if they were wild creatures, eternally screwed and on the hunt. He thought he saw a pair of legs dangling from a tree, or maybe just human-like branches, and he could see himself on the verge of being pursued, this small man who could run for 100 miles if need be, even in $1,000 shoes.
Shawnee,
Robert yelled, more for his own comfort. The silence seemed to reverberate, hollowing his ears. He imagined sitting on one of those rocks and chanting Om Namah Shivaya to the vision of the world around him. Deep, calming breaths, Om Namah Shivaya, allowing himself oneness with the universe and perhaps inspiring oneness with Shawnee. But closing his eyes seemed foolish right now. And what did those words mean? Seligman had never told him. Robert whistled. He clapped.
Shawnee, Shawnee.
The name Shawnee could have been equal with the name of God.
Shawnee.
A few more steps forward, and Robert foundered in mud. Damn. And then he thought he saw them, the herons, tiptoeing through dead leaves, watching him, knowing that his type spooked easily. So be careful, Maggie. Be careful, Stan. The four of them fanning around him, their hands spread in a Red Rover chain. Robert froze. His eyes went upward, looking again for some civilizing sign, better yet, for the rectangular peak of his building, like the needle of a compass, the darkness down here, the shadow of his life up there. Friedrich and Lana resting up for tomorrow, Paulette waiting for him, posed on all fours in bed. They were trying. He was trying. But above him there was just sky and trees in all directions.
That was David Gilbert reading his story, The Sightseers. He's been publishing fiction in The New Yorker since 1996. You can hear more New Yorker fiction read by the authors on NewYorker.com and on the New Yorker apps, available from the App Store or from Google Play. On the New Yorker Fiction Podcast, we invite writers to choose stories from the magazine's archives to read and discuss. This month, Lauren Groff reads In These Islands by Shirley Hazard. You can subscribe to that and other New Yorker podcasts by searching for The New Yorker in your podcast app. Tell us what you thought of this podcast by rating and reviewing The Writer's Voice in Apple Podcasts on iTunes. Our theme music is by Jordan Batiste and Ross Michaels of North American Plastics. The Writer's Voice is produced by Jill Duboff of NewYorker.com. I'm Deborah Treisman. Thanks for listening.